Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I hope that you've had a great day. If you'd like to call in and talk, the number is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, that's area code 855-346-3351, 855-346-3351. So I'm not sure how long we'll be on tonight, so if you want to give a call in the earlier and sooner, the better. Let's just see what's going on out there. Yesterday we had some great conversation around what's happening in the court system and around the rights of people who are being involved with court-ordered psychiatry. And I think that this definitely is something that we need to look closer at and continue talking about. As these are major concerns for people when they come on. One of the things that I had started out talking about yesterday was this in Seattle. There's this issue of Harborview to test drug on the unconscious without consent. And so talking about people who are getting a head injury, if somebody has a head injury or is unconscious, that they can be enrolled in the study without consent. And the study is testing a drug aimed at preventing brain bleeding, but that this is a major issue of how can somebody who is unconscious be have their right to informed consent just completely overlooked? And so the author of this study, Carol Ostrom writes. Bypassing informed consent, a long staple of human studies, is allowed under federal regulations, but only if researchers adequately inform their communities ahead of time and give people a chance to opt out. Ethics experts say there's little guidance on what constitutes adequate community consultation. So I'm not clear as to how this can happen, or the idea of people who don't have the ability to consent are perfectly fine to study. But apparently there's this way that people can opt out by requesting a, quote, no study bracelet. And so if you don't want to, if for some reason you were to get a traumatic brain injury or become unconscious and you were wearing this no study bracelet, then they would know that you were somebody who did not want to be part of the study, and then you would be able to be excluded from it. But if you don't have this no study bracelet, then you're not in it. So if you're in the Seattle area and you want to call in and make sure that you are not included in such a study over, without informed consent, not even over your objection, but because the community was informed, and part of the informed process, I guess, is that you have to opt out. The number to opt out of this study at Harborview is area code 206-744-7724. You might want to grab a pen or paper to write down this kind of information that comes out throughout the show, inevitably all kinds of websites and information that callers often have in. But to opt out of the study and to request a no-study bracelet, call area code 206-744-7724, or you can email pklotz@uw.edu. That's pklotz, P-K-L-O-T-Z, at uw.edu. It says that the Research Oversight Board for the study has approved the protocol, but researchers must present results of the community notification and reaction before getting final approval. Under opting out, the author writes, Anna says that he is not against such studies where researchers have reason to believe the experimental treatment might be better than the current practice. But he added, there's always sure, they're always sure it's going to work. The fact that you believe in it, that's good. It's good for religion, but it doesn't really help us for science. Everyone wants evidence-based treatments, he said, but if you had the evidence, you wouldn't be doing the study. He gives Harborview some credit for its community engagement plan. Using your newspaper is not stupid, Anna says, and he likes Bulger's plan to involve a local bicycle club because that's targeting a population vulnerable to TBIs. Anybody in the who works in the traumatic brain injury community who would like to give some input into this also, I think here's, you know, just another perfect example of where informed consent to be part of a study is just totally sideswiped and just a really a bizarre way of looking at it. So again, if you are in the Seattle area and want to opt out of this, potentially ever being a study participant in this testing of this drug, the number to call would be 206-744-7724. And then I guess you would get a no-study bracelet. I really wish that they put on a picture of what the no-study bracelet is. I guess then you also have to always be wearing the no-study bracelet. So, you know, any kind of testing can do this is totally questionable. And then you look at the idea of, like, what happens with people who aren't giving or who don't have the capacity to give informed consent. And the way, even like with the FDA in 2011, when the Neurological Devices Panel met to look at the use of the electroshock device, that for people who were experiencing quote unquote catatonia or couldn't speak or communicate, for them it was okay. And so for anybody else, not okay. But for somebody who can't object, then it was seen as okay. And I think that this is a big problem of what happens if somebody is unconscious or unable to give consent as to what happens and where their proxy is. But with this research, the thing that I think that is most troubling that's going on at Harborview is that the Institutional Review Board approved the plan that if they informed the community that this is what was going on, that it would be on the onus to opt out of the study is on the individual. And because they reached out to the community and maybe a bicycle club or something, that anybody who then is, you know, in this catchment area who winds up, you know, getting a brain injury or becoming unconscious is now subject to this kind of thing. So, again, quite a questionable around informed consent for people for any kind of medical study. If you'd like to call in to talk about this or anything else, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a call, toll-free line in the United States, you can call area code 855-346-3351. That's 855-346-3351. I know that there are many Bastille Day events that are going on all over the country and world. I did receive an email from Don Weitz, who has been on the show from Toronto, about a rant that he is going to be reading at the Mad Pride Day in Toronto on July 12th. And so I'm excited to see that. Don is active as ever, and getting the word out about shock doctors and why they need to be held accountable. And of course, the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day vigil is going to be July 13th, starting on Sunday. At 6 p.m., running through Wednesday at 6 p.m. on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health. And that should be, where people are sitting and holding vigil because 72 hours is how long that anybody can be detained, assessed, treated, in determination for whether or not they will be held longer. And there is no requirement for psychiatric history in order for that to happen. All that needs to happen is somebody needs to think that you are in need of a evaluation, and that is grounds then for having for them being allowed to pick you up and evaluate you. There's also, I don't know if there's any of you internet people who have been following this, but there's the Trans-Pacific Partnership Plan, and there's a petition going around that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, could censor expression online for generations. This could include comments that you make on YouTube or posts on Facebook or whole websites that can be blocked. And so there's an effort to try to stop, to protect freedom of speech on the internet, and to stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership from happening. And so it's my understanding that they're in the final stages of negotiating this, and that if internet expression is censored, you know, think about how many connections that we have been able to make simply because of the internet, how many people have been able to be reached, and where we're allowed to still talk about anti-psychiatry, for example, or questioning the system or challenging what's going on inside of it or organizing around that. And, you know, what happens if somebody comes in at some point and says, well, these types of thoughts or expressions are not considered legitimate. And so slightly out of the usual purview of what it is we talk about, but I think that because the internet is really our keystone for being able to communicate amongst people, that we should be concerned about what's going to happen with the TPP. So again, if you'd like to call in and talk about this or anything else, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. And if you're holding online, there are a whole bunch of people online. If you're holding online, please press 1 or star 1 if you would like to talk. And sometimes the technical issues have really overwhelmed. So I'm, you know, hoping that you're not trying to flag me and that you're just listening. And then this is where we go on. Okay, and so also the HR 3717, I received an email today from, I signed up for Congressman Tim Murphy's email alerts, and apparently there is another endorsement for the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act. This is from the Sacramento Bee. It says in this email from Murphy, it says, the Sacramento Bee is the latest major metropolitan newspaper urging passage of the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act, authored by Tim Murphy. The editorial comes during the exact week the very same reforms to the mental health system advanced in Dr. Murphy's bill are adopted at the local level. The article in Murphy's statement continues to go on saying, supervisors in San Francisco County, California, who voted to implement an assisted outpatient treatment program for the severely mentally ill, modeled on Dr. Murphy's HR 3717. Meanwhile, San Francisco lawmaker Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi has worked to stymie progress on AOT and HR 3717, according to a report in May by the Wall Street Journal. The paper reported that prospects for the passage of Dr. Murphy's bipartisan legislation were made more difficult by introduction of a partisan bill driven by Minority Leader Pelosi. The newspaper stated that legislation was designed to kill progress on reform for political reasons. So before I go on, I just want to make sure the Sacramento Bee, if you are, you know, on Twitter or following these people on any level, that to let the Sacramento Bee know that you object to them endorsing the H.R. 3717 and the use of assisted outpatient treatment. In the Sacramento Bee, which can be found at sacbee.com, sacbee.com, there is an editorial by the editorial board published on July 9th that says, headlining, San Francisco cast vote for compassion for people with severe mental illness. Yeah, involuntary outpatient commitment is compassion. If you've got anything to say about this as I'm talking, please do press 1 or star 1. So in this Sacramento Bee article, it says, in a vote that should prompt other California policymakers to act, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors approved an ordinance insisting that people who suffer from severe mental illness receive care rather than leave them to languish on the streets. Supervisor Mark Farrell authored the ordinance creating the Assisted Outpatient Treatment Program. San Francisco supervisors voted 9-2 for it on Tuesday, sending it to Mayor Ed Lee for his expected signature. San Francisco is the fourth county to fully embrace a 2002 statute known as Laura's Law, joining Novato, Yolo, and Orange counties. San Francisco is by far the most liberal, which is noteworthy. In the past, liberals have been the strongest opponents of insisting that people who are so sick that they don't know that they're ill receive care. The adoption of Laura's Law ordinance doesn't mean individuals will be forced into locked psychiatric wards. Rather, judges could issue orders compelling people to receive care while living in their homes, but I thought that they were homeless. So this is again, part of the fraud that is being perpetrated on the people here. If you live in California or know somebody who's in California who has some insight into this, please call in at area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167, and remember to press either 1 or star 1 in order to let me know that you would like to talk at any point. And so I'm just going to go back into this editorial in the Sacramento Bee. And again, the Sacramento Bee is who just endorsed Murphy's H.R. 3717, that many of us are fighting against. So it says that individuals are expected to attend therapy and take antipsychotic medication if psychiatrists deem them to be necessary. Family, police, and others could request that authorities evaluate individuals for inclusion in the program. To become subject to it, a person must have been hospitalized for mental illness or jailed in recent years. The 2002 law legislation that authored counties to adopt such an ordinance was named for Laura Wilcox, a college sophomore who was working as a temporary receptionist at the Nevada County Behavioral Health Department when a mentally ill man shot and killed her. Tragic. Nobody is advocating murder, but the idea that anybody who has a psychiatric history is now going to be associated with this kind of heinous act, and that laws are going to be put in place in order to try to stop these things from happening, which is absolutely impossible, is such a fraud. So it says, the Sacramento Bee editorial says, some misguided advocates for mentally ill people take the view that people should never be coerced to get care. I guess I'm part of that misguided advocate group, is according to that. I mean, but the idea that, you know, but there's still nowhere in here do they ever actually challenge the idea that, quote-unquote, mental illness is a fraudulent concept that doesn't have any actual evidence base to show that somebody has a, quote-unquote, mental illness. But clearly, the use of voluntary treatment doesn't work for some people. Farrell estimates that fewer than 1,000 of San Francisco's 780,000 residents might become part of the program. So 1,000 people subjected now to this kind of torture. Other counties should take note of San Francisco's action, as should California's congressional delegation. Representative Tim Murphy, the Sacramento Bee editorial says, a Republican Pennsylvania is pushing H.R. 3717, which would free federal funds for expanded care for the most severely mentally ill people and relax federal privacy laws that denies family members access to information about mentally ill loved ones. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy of Bakersfield ought to make this issue a priority, the editorial says. Republicans who have not joined Murphy and are Representatives Doug LaMalva of Richland, Tom McClintock of Elk Grove, and Jeff Denham of Turlock. Congratulations. LaMalva, McClintock, and Grove, and I'm sorry, Denham, have not joined Murphy in this move for H.R. 3717. And Democrats Doris Matsui of Sacramento and John Garamendi of Walnut Grove have not signed on either. So there's a handful of people who have not signed on to these efforts yet. And so if you're out in California way, these are the people that you want to be getting in touch with. Several congressional members, the editorial goes on to say, were in the legislature in 2002 and voted for Laura's law, including McClintock and Costa and Speria of Hillsborough. They should add their voices in support of Murphy's bill. Some people say care in the form of assisted outpatient treatment is the last resort. It's not. The last resort is when mentally ill people commit suicide, become victims of violence, or commit crimes that land them in prison. At least I said that this was editorial. So that's what we're up against. Anybody want to talk to me? There's a lot of people online who are listening in. If you'd like to talk, please press 1 or star 1. And if you'd like to call in and talk about this or anything else, it's area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, it's area code 855-346-3351. It's area code 855-346-3351. So the Sacramento Bee is endorsing Murphy, and going back to the email from Murphy, it says... it said that Representative Murphy told the crowds he would not abandon the family whose loved ones suffer with a persistent and serious mental illness. Instead, he would continue to press forward with reforms that will help to deliver care to the 40% to 50% of persons with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder who cannot voluntarily seek treatment because they lack insight into their own condition and, if left untreated, could deteriorate to the point of harm. To learn more, please click here. So I'm clicking here, and it just brings you right over to Murphy's page where he's got, you know, all of his ducks in a row and his nice little videos and all of his television appearances and the language of the bill. I'd really like to know of where they're now getting this statistic of 40 to 50% of persons with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder who cannot voluntarily. This is such a load. Will you please call in and talk to me at area code 267-521-0167 if you have any insights into this. Thanks. Area code 419, your line is open.
Hi, Lauren. It's Pat Risser.
Hey, Pat. How are you?
I'm good, and I'm just as appalled by you are. But I think I know an answer to your question of where they get these statistics from. It, quite simply, they make them up.
Yeah.
I mean...
Right?
You know, NAMI is the family member organization, and they're kind of backing this because, you know, that's aimed at helping families in mental health, you know, sort of crisis act. They're not helping those of us who have the lived experience. They're interested in helping families in the same way that, you know, in the past on web pages they've done things like encourage families, if they call the police, to have us civilly committed to turn over furniture so the police will think we did it. And they encourage similar kinds of lies. And it's because, you know, quite honestly, you know, families think that we're a pain in their behind and they want to control us.
It really is about social control, but I feel like these people should be held responsible for these statistics that and they keep on getting greater. Right now it's 40% to 50%. You know, the other day it was like 1% of 1% of, you know, 1%. Now it's 40% to 50% of people. Like that they're, you know, that nobody is holding them accountable for truth, and the ideas of the social control that are behind this are getting totally covered up. And people's civil liberties just
Well, social control has always been a part of what psychiatry is about. From, you know, in the 1800s, you know, men would, you know, have their wives committed for not being compliant enough. And I mean, even into more modern times, Leonard Frank became a vegetarian and had adapted a lifestyle that his family disagreed with. So they had him electroshocked. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that families, and I want to be clear, it's families of adults, people who ought to be making their own decisions, and the whole notion that we somehow don't know what's good for us is another fiction, another lie that they make up. And E. Fuller Torrey is a psychiatrist who uses the word anosognosia to describe that phenomena. And yet, if you're familiar with anosognosia, it is indeed a neurological condition where people are not aware of their physical condition, but it always follows a stroke. And there are actual brain lesions proving it, whereas in psychiatry, there is no brain lesion to prove that we don't know what's good or isn't good for us. And even so, I mean, as adults, we ought to be allowed to make our own mistakes, make choices that are different from those choices other people make.
Yeah, and risk the dignity to fail. I mean, This is so with no evidence, and dating back for centuries. And I'm, you know, so glad you called in, and maybe you'll be willing to talk a little bit about some of the historical work that you've done. But that there is no evidence for this, and the fact that these newspapers are just glomming this up, and that San Francisco, the most liberal place, right, in the entire country, is putting this forward and passing this, and these poor, you know, quote-unquote mentally ill people. And, you know, and then there's this line where it says, you know, that we're going to, rather than to leave them languish on the streets, and then three paragraphs down, it says, that, you know, that they're, you know, that they're not going to be put into institutions, that they're going to receive their, you know, quote-unquote antipsychotic medications at home. And so if somebody is living on the streets, how are they going to be receiving their medication at home? There's just nobody calls them out for the realities of what this is going to subject people to. And having, like, the most liberal place in the world now supporting this, I think, is another thing we need to be concerned about.
Well, San Francisco has the illusion of being this very liberal, livable place, but it hasn't come without a lot of struggle on the part of people who lived there. We know a psychiatrist, I'm not at liberty to name because I don't have her permission, but we know a psychiatrist who actually got fired or quit because she was told that she was to put her clients into these board and care homes in San Francisco, but when she went and visited, she was so appalled at how awful the conditions were there that she said, no, I refuse to put my people in these homes, and politically it cost her job. So, you know, they're very proud of this illusion of liberalness, but politically that they're actually, you know, fairly conservative in a lot of ways. You know, it's like, oh, well, if we lose these board and care homes that are oppressive and horrible for the people, then where will we put our people, you know? And they're just bizarre in their thought.
It really is. And, you know, and I'm just, as I'm looking around, and because I'm just, you know, kind of coming to this, I'm wondering if this is somehow in conjunction with what passed in H.R. 4302, where the assisted outpatient treatment grant program passed to 50 grants to places that have not before had assisted outpatient treatment programming. And so I'm wondering.
It could be, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. And you know, I just, you know, California is a strange conglomerate of folks that, you know, there are certain liberal pockets and there are certain very, very conservative pockets. But my problem with all of this is I agree with you. There is no such thing as mental illness. It's never been proven. There's not a shred of evidence. You know, you can't put it under a microscope slide and see it. So what we're really addressing here is not even truly an illness. And when I started, you know, helping other folks, it was back in the 60s and 70s. I was a volunteer at a free clinic, very popular back then, and it was just sort of being with people, helping people, just listening to people. And I helped a lot of people through a lot of what would be called often a bad trip. Well, you know, I'm still doing the same thing, only now they call it mental illness. And it's just being with people and supporting people and being understanding. And I've never had a license or wanted to have a license to prescribe psychiatric drugs. And I think that, you know, we've sort of lost that human connection to the people that that get talked about in all of this. And I want, you know, I really want people to understand mental illness does not cause violence.
Right.
Not only because there is no such thing as mental illness, but even if there were some alleged illness, that's not what causes violence. Violence comes from anger. And anger is a normal human emotion. And yet, we as a society have grown to be afraid of emotions. You know, if somebody is feeling sad, it's like, oh, no, you've got depression. You need to go see a psychiatrist and take a pill. Or if you're grieving, oh, no, you've got depression. Go see a psychiatrist. Take a pill. And if you're angry, that's a big, scary emotion. And people are like, oh, no, you need to go see a doctor and do something about that. And anger and emotion really scares people. And yet, you know, in like domestic violence courts and other situations, we'll send people to anger management classes where we teach people how to feel and safely express their emotions. And I think that, you know, if Adam Lanza and in Newport, Connecticut, and these other people who committed these acts of violence were somehow had that connection like we had at the free clinics, you know, just somebody who cares. And if they were able to safely feel and express those emotions, I think there'd be a lot of people still alive. And, I, you know, so what I'm saying is not only are these NAMI folks and Murphy and Tory and all of the Treatment Advocacy Center and the rest of those folks, not only are they getting it wrong, but they're also not proposing a solution. What they're proposing is something that will create and generate more anger and more emotion, And left unresolved, I see the violence escalating rather than figuring out how to address it. And I'm just afraid, you know, create more force, make people more angry, and then we see more violence, and we're entering into some sort of a vicious cycle that doesn't really help people, and instead is going to scapegoat and blame and create bigger problems.
Absolutely, and I think that this you made so many good points, but I want to just pick up on this issue of emotion for a second, because I think, you know, from a psychological perspective, there are like 6 or 7 basic emotions, right? Like anger, disgust, fear, sadness, surprise, which may or may not be good, and happiness. So the bulk of like the feelings that humans have the capacity for experiencing are negative. Right? We've got happiness and maybe surprise, right? So the idea of teaching people or helping people or even just saying to people, yeah, like for the majority of the time, like there's you're more apt to have negative emotions than you are to have positive emotions, and how to deal with those kinds of experiences and those feelings. And I think like with Elliot Rodger, with this, you know, the Isla Vista situation of where they're saying, well, if there had been more information, then the police would have been able to detain him. But the police were there and saw nothing wrong. So, like, the idea that police can detect who is going to become violent is just also an illegitimate fact. I mean, unless they want to have everybody just locked up and then nothing will ever happen except what happens in the, you know, institutions, which nobody ever talks about, violence toward us, the assaults that we constantly are subject to while institutionalized. But there's this other major issue of, you know, what would have happened if, you know, the parents of these young people who often are the perpetrators of these mass violence episodes that then anybody with a psychiatric history winds up suffering for in the law, for, you know, however long to come, had dealt with the situation differently. So, for example, Elliot Rodger, you know, in his videos complained all the time about the fact that he wasn't having sex and that there wasn't, that the women weren't treating him the way, like, women treated everybody else and all of this other stuff. And then, you know, I don't know if you ever, I almost never watch television, but there's a show called, I think, Californication, on HBO or Showtime or one of those shows. Are you familiar with this at all?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so anyways, it's again, you know, and Hollywood-based kind of thing, but where the kid who is struggling with, you know, his sexuality winds up getting a prostitute, which I'm not saying is, you know, a good or bad thing, but doesn't the idea that young men are struggling with their sexuality and trying to make sense of the world that they're living in versus the world that they're being portrayed by the media, and being given some kind of examples around how to do that, that there are other ways that go about. I mean, I'm not making, I don't know if I'm making exact sense here, but the idea that that this wound up becoming an issue of this kid not having had appropriate psychiatric evaluation and treatment, and had he had been forced into it, that none of this would have happened, and that they're blanketly using these and associating these and conditioning the public into thinking that this is legitimate, of every time they try to take our civil liberties away, they throw in one of these, you know, acts of violence as if it's associated with psychiatry. And Pat, your point of that anger is what causes violence, not some psychiatric label, whether it exists or not, I think is urgently important that people understand, and that suicide very often is like anger turned inward, and homicide is anger turned outward, right? And so, like, how do you get people to deal with anger and living in the society that we're living in? But the majority of people who are being subjected by this are not driving around in expensive cars and have all kinds of economic availability to them. This is, you know.
Well, we live in a society that's kind of sad in a number of ways. We treat people as less than fully human. If they somehow don't meet expectations. I see people going to work who literally step over the bodies of the homeless. And just the homeless for them have become invisible and less than fully human. Well, I also, you know, am very concerned about trauma issues. And I see families where the parents treat the children as they are somehow less than. They're chattel, they're owned, they can be mistreated and abused. I see families where the man abuses the woman or the woman abuses the man. I see people hurting and abusing others. And then I also think about things like our veterans and the trauma. We train our soldiers specifically to see the other as less than fully human. Because if you've got them in your sights, you might not be able to pull a trigger if you actually saw them as a human being. And so we don't undo it when they come back home. We don't somehow unbrainwash people to appreciate humanity when they come back home. And so, you know, everything from child abuse to domestic violence to our veterans coming back, all over the place, I see a society that has grown used to trauma and abuse. And how is that responded to? It's responded to with anger. And that anger leads to violence. We need to find ways to reconnect as human beings. And I don't think that the psychiatric system is the answer. I personally think it's going to take entire communities. I think we're going to have, you know, one kid in school looking at the kid beside him in the next desk over. And if that kid in the next desk over is isolating and withdrawing and brooding, make that connection and say, you know, what's going on? Is there something, you know, make a connection with that person. If it's the person across the aisle in church, in the next pew, make that connection. If it's your neighbor, your second cousin, I think it's going to take entire communities. And that's another problem I have with Murphy and all this, is it's sort of saying that somehow the mental illness system has some answer, and I don't think they do. I think the answer has to come from our bigger society and communities.
Right, and you know, you were saying before that in the 60s and 70s you used to just go and just be with people and sit with people, and I think that that's, you know, we're so far removed from that a little bit. But I'm wondering, would you tell people about what that was a little bit more like what that was like, but maybe what you think it should be like now in that process of, and things that we might be able to learn from historically of what would work? Because I don't think it's HR 3717 either. I think that this is just going to be drugging and institutionalizing people and creating more money for the court systems and all this. But what would work? Because clearly when you have people who are, you know, in situations of where they've been abused as children or they're currently being abused as children or they're in domestic violence situations or they're veterans coming back or they're just people who have been, you know, traumatized by psychiatry, what kind of thing in society do we need to be doing in order to be improving experiences for people overall?
Well, you know, we need to protect our children as communities. We need to look out for and stop abuse in its tracks. We have the ability to do that. You know, if I see somebody, you know, hurting a child in Walmart, you know, I'm not afraid to go up. And I don't go to the person and say, oh, gosh, you know, stop hurting that child. I go up to the person and say, you seem like you're having a really rough time. Is there anything I can do to help? It's the person who's got the difficulty. And just be there, make a connection, offer You know, and if nothing else, it'll maybe slow them down enough that they start thinking. And right now, there's one place I know of where it's working, and that's Tarpon Springs, Florida. They have created what is, to my knowledge, the first trauma-informed community in the country. And the mayor saw people coming to court and coming to her with a problem, and then she'd, you know, try some solution, and next thing she knows, people are coming with the same problem over and over and over. And she thought she really needed to do something about it, and the more she thought about it, the more she noticed that what they had in common was the trauma. And so the mayor set out to create Tarpon Springs as a trauma-informed community. She got help from SAMHSA, our federal government. Some folks went in and talked to them. But she really was the driving force behind it and said, you know, I have the political will. And now you've got school kids in even elementary school, you know, making up little flyers and posters and drawings and things in school. And there's a level of awareness there of the issues that I think is probably the safest place in the country. I don't think an Adam Lanza could thrive or even survive in Tarpon Springs, Florida, because people would notice it. It would stand out. People would be reaching out and making that connection, saying, what's going on, Adam? You know, what can we do to help you? You know, what's happening, and how can we help you? And I'm trying to do the same thing in my tiny little Midwestern town of Ashland, Ohio. And I encourage other people. You know, we started, you know, 7 years ago with an annual recovery conference. But we bring in speakers, you know, Darby Penny. We bring in people, you know, nationally known, recognized people in the field of trauma, and we have them as speakers, and we put on, you know, an annual conference to raise consciousness. And we try to get our political leaders on board, and, you know, we just talk about it and get it out there in the public. Every month, I think it's March or April, there's Child Abuse and Neglect Awareness Month. And we put up signs and posters, and we even have pinwheels we put out on a public lawn by a public thoroughfare, so you can see how many cases there have been of confirmed abuse and neglect in our community, and just raise consciousness and awareness and really work at trying to help people figure out how to solve this problem in our tiny little community. It can happen anywhere. We just need to get people on board, and there has to be the political will to support it. And that brings me back to where we started with this conversation. Is right now in San Francisco, unfortunately, although the solution and the correct understanding is out there, they don't have the political will to do it.
Right, and so they do have the political will to pass these kinds of laws with no evidence of anything, and this is the assisted outpatient treatment and support. Murphy and their newspapers and their media, the Sacramento Bee endorsing H.R. 3717, and, you know, and at the same time, you know, they're not stopping abuse in its tracks, and they're just further brainwashing. I like this question that you posed before about unbrainwashing people, like how are we going to unbrainwash people? And I feel like society has been so conditioned into believing this garbage that's what we need to do. And so places like Tarpon Springs, Florida, that you were talking about as a trauma-informed community, that's really great in what you're doing in Ashland, Ohio, right?
Yes, and you know, it can happen anywhere, but not where you get people who are just not using their heads. It's so easy to scapegoat and blame the mentally ill as it is to blame the homeless or, you know, whatever. And that sort of scapegoating is just, you know, that's that's the problem I have with Murphy, is that he's basically swallowed the Treatment Advocacy Center Kool-Aid. He's bought into their line. He likes to claim he's this great psychologist, and yet he's not a practicing psychologist. He's a politician, and even when he was supposedly being a psychologist, he was a child psychologist, and that's what really upsets me, is he should know and understand about the abuse that drove Adam Lanza to basically commit suicide by cop by killing a bunch of other people, you know, and that's what happens in most of these cases, is people are driven to that level of desperation, and, you know, we need to get to them before things get that desperate and let them know that there is an alternative path that you know, they can follow and not have to, you know, take that desperate path to the end.
And I think that is really so important, and for people who are survivors to speak out and to let other people know, young people, any people of any age, know that, you know, you can push through this and that there are ways of getting around it, and sometimes it's just something that sticks with you and you learn how to react to it differently, you know, for lack of a better word of being able, because I don't like putting a spin on it, like everything's going to be all, you know, as a survivor, I still, you know, some of the same things that got me locked up are still things that I deal with every day, and so they haven't gone away just because I've rejected psychiatry, you know what I mean? It's just that
for sure.
You know, well, like that.
Two things. First of all, that they use this name, assisted outpatient treatment. Well, first of all, it's nothing assisted about it. And second of all, it is not treatment. We need to fight that misperception right from the outset. It is a legal process.
A legal process of torture. And
a legal process is not treatment. That's a misnomer to begin with. But you reminded me, you know, I survived. I'm an abuse survivor myself, and I repressed a lot of those memories, and so I ended up, you know, spending a few years of my life as a mental patient, because I expected, you know, others to have the answer to help me and make me feel better. And I look at how that happened, and I think, you know, I was taught from infancy, trust doctor, doctor will fix it. If you have something wrong, go see doctor. And so I was sort of raised and brainwashed to believe in the power of authority, particularly as it's embodied in doctor. And so much of our society has been brainwashed in that way. And I feel like, you know, a big part of my job, as I perceive it, is to try and deprogram people from this cult of psychiatry. But,
yeah.
You know, I was locked up in a mental hospital over 20 times. And I tell people, you know, I'm kind of a slow learner, I guess. It took me that long to figure it out, but, you know, I did figure it out. If that had happened in this day, I'd be locked up on a back ward someplace and forgotten about. But I was able to get out and try it again and try it again until I figured out what worked to keep me out. Well, normally what would happen is the emotion of the abuse and trauma and stuff would come rising to the surface, and I would get so despondent and so much emotional pain that I would make a suicide attempt to end that pain. And I'd go tell some mental health professional and that, you know, oh, I'm having these suicidal thoughts. They would panic, and in their panic, they would lock me up. Well, I'm proud to report that I don't get locked up anymore for two reasons. First of all, I don't go telling those poor mental health professionals anymore because they obviously can't handle it without panicking.
Good for you.
But second of all, I've grown to the point where I've learned to cope with my own feelings, my own emotions. Yes, I still feel suicidal, sometimes regularly, sometimes off, but that doesn't mean I need to be locked up for having a feeling. Now, you know, half the time, most of what happens is I say, gosh, where did that come from? Why am I having that thought now? That's odd. You know, it's odd that I would have that thought now. Wonder what's going on. And and I've learned that, you know, live with my feelings and cope with my feelings, and I don't get locked up anymore. I haven't been locked up in a lot of years, and I don't think I will be ever again. But,
yeah, I hope
I don't go to them because they can't handle it, and kind of household figured out that I can handle it.
I think it's so important that people, like, are exposed to this kind of message because, you know, like I said, just because I rejected psychiatry doesn't mean that all of this other stuff that got me involved with it has gone away. And, you know, it's been a long time since I've been locked up, too, and I don't go to them anymore either. But if I did, and, you know, when people call in, Pat, all the time that they're scared to go to a medical doctor because they're going to have to go through a psych eval first. And I've gone through that myself, but people literally within, you know, since the show has started have called in that they went, they had something physical, they were bleeding, they had something you could see on their skin, they had some kind of pain, they had something going on, and before whatever doctor they dealt with at the emergency room would deal with them, that they had to be evaluated on a psychiatric level because it said that they had a psychiatric history in their chart. And things like H.R. 3717 that are just going to wind up, you know, with the electronic medical records now and how everybody is being tracked and everything that you've ever done in your life is going to be right there and probably imprinted in some chip that they plant in you soon. Like, you know, this is, you know, so there's this real fear that people have to talk to anybody. And, you know, and if you're having a bad day, if you don't, like, for listeners who may just not know anything about this and may just be stumbling over the show and just, you know, like what, for people to know that the actual, like, screening for a mental health evaluation that's happening at a general practitioner and under the Affordable Care Act is mandated for everybody who sees a doctor, mandated alcohol and drug screenings and mental health screenings, that they literally ask you, like, how's your day or, you know, how are you feeling? And if you happen to be having, like, a day or a couple of, you know, weeks or whatever that, you know, you're having something that's off, something you're disappointed about something, you've lost a loved one, you're not having, you know, you're having some issue with work or school or family or friends, that's it. You're done. And you answered, you know, one of those questions wrong and you're off. With the veterans, if you answer the question, like, whether or not you think your life would be better off if you weren't around, and you're having fights with everybody and everybody is calling with you, you know, whatever is going on in your life, and you feel like him, yeah, like maybe, you know, just a feeling, not that it's real, just a feeling, they direct you as a veteran to call 911 on yourself or get yourself to the nearest emergency room. And it's a product, and it's a product of, like, Pfizer, and it's like the PHQR-9 or something like that, you know, the depression screening test. And so, like, you know, if you really take this seriously, if you're really struggling, and, you know, a lot of people who call in are, like, if you're having some emotional crisis, if you're really struggling, know that there are ways to get through it. But if you take psychiatry seriously because you don't know anything about this and you're just now dealing with some issue or you're dealing with a friend or a loved one who's dealing with something and you read what it is it says, it's like, holy shit, I've got to get myself to an emergency room or call the cops on myself right now.
Well, I you know, people have forgotten what it's like to be normal and to have normal emotions. I mean, everything that psychiatry does is through a lens of pathology. And, you know, if you go looking for something, you're going to find it, you know?
Right.
And you know, normal people have a lousy day. Do I need to talk to your doctor? Did you take your meds today? You know, normal
people. Somebody who hasn't been assigned.
Week.
Yeah, somebody who hasn't been assigned or suspected of something, quote-unquote, psychiatric, is allowed to, they're allowed to do whatever they want. They can start yelling and screaming, banging on walls. I mean, they can do whatever
hey,
the hell they want.
I've seen psychiatrists do that, too. They're scary people when they get angry. Boy, I tell you, I've seen them on a unit get angry at other staff. You know, I don't know if I ever told you, but the way I got miraculously cured, I told you I was hospitalized over 20 times, including
right.
state hospital. And I was sitting there in the state hospital playing cards at a table with like four or five other people. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm a little slow, but all of a sudden it dawned on me, God, this is normal. I could have this on the outside. I don't need to be locked up to have this. And then I looked over at the nurse's station, and I saw the chaos that was going on there, and I thought, now that's crazy. and I said, okay, I got to get what I got going on now, sitting here playing cards and loving life with the people. I got to get that on the outside, and I'll never have to come back. And I never went back. I don't mean to make it sound like, you know, like flipping on a light switch and it was that easy, because it wasn't. It took, you know, 10 to 15 years of my life to get as messed up as I was. Ended up having five heart attacks from years of complying with psychiatric drugs, but it took, you know, 10 years or more to get it put back together, and I set out to find, you know, where can I hang with people? Where can I find others? How can I build the support in my life? If I need support at 2 o'clock in the morning, do I have people in my life that I could call? Do I have more than one in case that one is on vacation? And I really set out
or
to create
out, right?
that. Yeah, that too. Which is kind of funny because I tell people who swear by psychiatric drugs, I say, you know what, if you're suffering from depression, the best cure I got, club on Friday night with a couple of friends, throw back a few brews, have a few good belly laughs, and if you don't feel better next week, come see me, I'll write your prescription to do it again.
I think, you know, I think that it's really, it's such a struggle, and when people are in it, and having been in it, and occasionally falling back in it, you know, when you're in it, you're in it. And so sometimes it's so, even though that may be like within your grasp to say that's really what I should be doing, to be even able to get and do that is sometimes really difficult. But what I found was once I stopped trying to do that with people who didn't get what it was that I was going through and started doing it with people who did get what it was that I was going through, that a lot of the barriers to even getting to do it were lessened just from being around people who get it. And being
yeah,
around
well,
their survivors, you know what I mean. That there's some things that you know that when seeing other people who have survived these kinds of things or other things and seeing them live and
yeah,
I don't want to
demonize alcohol like I see a lot of people do when so many normal people go out on Friday night after a hard week of work and you know, have a couple of drinks and it's okay. And that's how they let their hair down and that's how they relax.
I'm trying to get Jack Daniels to sponsor this. What are you talking about? Like, literally, like, that's who I'm going to, like, to get advertising for this radio show. I'm going to, like, alcohol companies. I'm going to Jack Daniels and places like that. Because we're told and we're prevented from being their, quote-unquote, consumers of alcohol or different, you know, things like that. That if you're, you know, assigned as a mental patient, you're not allowed to drink, you're not allowed to smoke, you're not allowed to eat chocolate, you're not allowed to do any of these things. So all the things
right.
that they take away from me are all of the places that I'm going to look for advertising for the show, including Jack
oh,
Daniels.
Yeah.
That's my first spot.
Use the drugs that we use more than anybody else. Mental patients are known to smoke more than the average, you know, population. So, you know, I think you ought to get Marlboro and Camel to sponsor, you know. because that's the drugs that we use, you know. But I'm just joking, of course. Please don't send in hate mail to Lawrence Radio Show. I do want to share one other tip that really helped me. There was a period of time when I was so depressed and despondent that I almost like could not get off the couch for months at a time. I was, you know, it was all I could manage to barely make it to the bathroom, you know, barely eating, barely hanging on to life. And I had a friend of mine come over, my best friend came over, and he said, "Oh no, I'm sorry, I'm not letting you do this." And he literally dragged me kicking and screaming out of my apartment. And he took me to, of all things, the figure eight auto races. Now, all of my senses became engaged. I could not ignore the sights, the sounds, the smells, the taste, the feeling on my skin of the warm sun and you know, the little bits of rubber from the tires and things. I was almost in sensory overload at the figure eight auto races, and miraculously, while I was in this sensory overload, I couldn't be in that despondent place that I had been in. And it wasn't the solution, it wasn't the cure, but what it was it gave me this tiny little shred of hope that things could be different, that it didn't have to be the way it was on that couch all the time. And just to know that it could be different, that something could change, was helpful and helped to start me on a journey to getting better. And that's why I tell people, you know, go volunteer at a soup kitchen, help other people. When your attention is directed outside of yourself and you are as fully engaged as possible, you can't be dwelling within yourself in that miserable place. And, you know, that's just one hint that I can pass on, but there are many of us in this movement for human rights who can pass along similar hints and notions and ideas to help people who are struggling with it. And it all makes so much more sense than what Murphy and those folks are pressing for as force. We would help people, you know, voluntarily and find ways to help people resolve their own issues and you know, using truth and not fictional made-up lies like these other folks do.
Right, and that's for people who are looking for some kind of assistance and support. And then there's this whole other group of people who get tagged out by psychiatry because they've had some, you know, spiritual experience or political viewpoint that is opposing what the people who are around them believe, or have a different sexual practice, or you know, something of where they are put into where their behavior is making those around them uncomfortable, therefore they must be you know, psychiatrically, you know, there must be some kind of psychiatric assignment put on them, or, you know, that they're quote-unquote mentally ill. And so, like, for people who are having, you know, spiritual experiences that a psychiatrist then sees as a hallucination or a delusion, you know, or, you know, that there's this whole other group of issues that are happening. So people who are, like, seeking out support and assistance or, you know, being just drugged and locked up and dehumanized, and people who are not wanting it and are just wanting to have their experience or being, you know, drugged and dehumanized. And what this H.R. 3717, you know, this point that you made, that this is a legal process. This is something that Yvonne brings up all the time and others, that assisted outpatient, involuntary outpatient commitment, the quote-unquote assistant treatment program, outpatient treatment program, that it's not treatment, and that this is a legal process. And when you look at the grants and what was passed in 4302, and I think this is why all these localities are now pushing it pushing forward, because like even in Massachusetts, there was a AOT program that they were trying to get through, and this is all probably because of the grant that was done in the 4302 that takes out the majority of the H.R. 3717 text around the assisted outpatient treatment and passed it for localities to get funding. But what it funds is them being able to pay people to figure out who should be in the involuntary outpatient commitment program, what their treatment plan should be. It pays people to file the petitions against people. Like, this is what this grant, this H.R. 3717 would pay for. And so, you know, when people say that this is a legal process, that this is really what's being paid for. It's just people to go and find people and turn them in, file petitions for them, and recommend programming that they then have to comply with.
Yeah, well, there's a couple different populations that I worry about. You know, I got sucked in. Like I said, I was trained from infancy. If you have a problem, go see doctor, trust doctor, doctor will fix it. And I was trained to trust that authority, and so I did, and I got sucked in as a mental patient for a number of years. But, you know, so I worry about how do we get the message out to the greater society that there are other answers. And like I said, my approach is to use one that is trauma-sensitive and trauma-focused and enlist the aid of entire communities to address this and to stop the violence. Then the other population, though, are those who have been already sucked in to the psychiatric mental illness system. By the way, I'll get back to that, but I want to point out we're talking about a mental illness system, not a mental health system. We have never, ever in this country sat down and had the discussion of what actually constitutes mental health. We wouldn't know it if it walked down the street right in front of us. We couldn't point to it and say, that's mental health. There's no way we can diagnose it or figure out what it is. We've never had that discussion. And I remember that several years ago, the country of Bhutan had a study of gross national happiness for their population. And they looked at things like, do you have green space in your life? Can you look out a window? Do you have a window? Can you look out that window? Can you see, you know, something nature outside of your window and things like that? Well, that led to some other discussions.
Stay away from
that led to some other discussions in England, where they were talking about it might be the capacity to feel joy. You know, you don't have to be joyous at the moment, but do you have that capacity or not? And even newborn babies might have that capacity. And if they lacked it, then that would be something that we would want to address and help somebody with. But it might be the ability to achieve and appreciate solitude. Can you get to a place where you can live with the voices inside your own head? Or is there some place where you can actually get away from the chaos of our society and life and just, you know, get a break? But anyway, we've never talked about what is mental health. So getting back to what I was saying about mental illness, I forget what I was saying, so I'm sorry.
Oh, well, just the way that they program people into believing and the system is a mental illness system, not a...
So once people are sucked into the system, then, you know, first we need to try and keep people from getting sucked in. But once they are sucked in, we have to figure out a way to help people escape from that system. And that's where a lot of our movement focuses on, you know, helping people to figure out how do you safely withdraw from the drugs if that's your choice. How do you safely, you know, find other ways to cope and things like that. And I think that you know, that's an entirely different population. And for that population, I'm thinking like you know, there's so much coming down with the Murphy bill and all of the rest of this movement in this country. I'm feeling like it might be time to consider, you know, have the discussion of, is there a way we can create an underground railroad to help people escape? You know, maybe if you go across state lines, the mental health hold that was on you, the civil commitment, no longer applies because you escaped a jurisdiction. Maybe there are some things that we can do to help people, but it would have to be coupled with that level of support and you know, helping people find ways to live and have jobs and things like that. But I think there's a whole population there that we need to consider, and I think those are going to be, you know, some of the leaders in the future in this battle for our human rights.
Yeah, I think that people have, you know, things that like the HR 3717 do, I think, is it prohibits that kind of interstate travel, per se, for people. The same way, like with Kendra's law now, in New York, they've eliminated the ability for people to move county to county any longer. And so I'm not sure what the issues are from state to state, but I know there are some people who are really interested in doing these kinds of things and who are actively working toward trying to make safe spaces for people so that they can get out, because where do you go? And you know, when you're with the electronic medical records and the legal records, I'm sure are all electronic now too, right? Like,
yeah.
you get one file and one chip, and it's all put in there, and so.
Well, that's how we got to help people escape and get off the radar. I mean, luckily, I live in a part of the country where there's huge Amish and Mennonite populations, and there are ways to get off the grid and you know, become more self-sufficient. But, you know, I don't think that's going to work for everybody by any means. But I certainly think I've been, you know, speaking pretty openly in all of this discussion, and certainly been, I would think, more than controversial. Are there any folks on the line who want to jump in here and chime in?
Well, I'm wondering. There are a lot of folks on the line, and I'm going to open up area code 315. I'm going to take a dare here and just do that. But if you'd like to call in and join in the conversation, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, it's area code 855-346-3351. Area code 315.
I had the heart attack and everything, and then now that I've changed my lifestyle and all, I play, you know, because like I was
George?
Talking about it, like the lifestyle was how to do it, but I had the heart attack, and oh man, I can do it now.
George,
I can stand on my head right now.
Somebody is on area code 315, but I don't think they hear us. I think there's a delay going on, and so they're a step behind it. But if there's somebody who would like to talk, area code, there are others online. I'll open up 503 if you'd like to say something. 503, your line is open. Okay. So people may just want to be listening, but for those of you who are online, if you press 1 or star 1 to let me know. Pat, do you remember which you pressed?
Which? I'm sorry, what?
When you pressed either 1 or star 1, do you remember which one you pressed?
I pressed star 1.
Star 1. Okay, because there tends to be a lot of technical difficulty with this sometimes of which line people are calling on, which it comes in on. So it's either star 1 or 1 if you would like to talk about this or anything else. But I do think that, you know, it is a cult of psychiatry. There are, you know, there is a, you know, text, what the institutional ethnographers that I've learned would call the boss text of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. and it's entirely subjective and made up and highly grounded in social control. And I just like this thing that you said before about unbrainwashing people. How do you unbrainwash somebody?
Well, you know, I often speak out against psychiatric drugs, and I'm a pretty outspoken opponent of it, and I do so for like three reasons. First of all, I do it because there are so many forces arrayed on the other side who are speaking in favor of the drugs, and that includes, you know, psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists, case managers, family, friends, the media, big pharma. Everybody's speaking out in favor of it. So sometimes I'll feel, you know, sometimes I'll go on that radical extreme opposite just to try and balance things a little bit and give a little balance to people's thought process. Then the next reason why I speak out against it is because, like I said, 15 years of psychiatric drugs led, I believe, directly to my having to weakening my heart to the point where I've survived 5 heart attacks. And I think there is a real danger to just sort of blindly, you know, taking these poisons in your body. And then the third reason is because people are brainwashed into believing that these things are somehow good for us, that we shouldn't challenge or shouldn't question. And I really will question and challenge just because I want to, like, you know, I think it's almost like Stockholm syndrome, where people, oh, no, I don't dare question my oppressor. I mean, they really like me. They really care for me, you know, and I'm like, you know, how do I deprogram from them, from this whole cult that's got them buying into all of this and help them overcome it? And I can't get there by compromise, you know. It's like if I went to work and I wanted a raise of a dollar, I wouldn't go in and ask for a dollar. I'd go in and ask for $2. Then the boss comes back and says, well, I'll give you 50 cents. And I say, well, how about a buck and a half? And eventually I get the dollar raise that I wanted. And so I kind of will use that opposite extreme to try and negotiate, you know, a happier medium. But I just don't see people doing that in their thought processes, and people are just blindly accepting, and it's really tragic and scary.
It is scary, and I think that, you know, the physical results of taking the bodily injury that is occurs through taking these drugs, and then the long-term impact of it that we have no idea about. I mean, obviously, the physical, that these things are poison, and that they shouldn't have any more legitimacy because they're prescribed by a psychiatrist than an illicit street drug, and people should take them with the same amounts of caution and consent. You don't see anybody, like, you know, routinely, you know, injecting people, forcing people to comply with street drugs. And so we raise them to the idea of the idea that because they're quote-unquote medicine, that somehow it's acceptable to force people onto these things. But they're probably as dangerous, if not more dangerous, than many of the street drugs. But then this issue of how people are really brainwashed into it. And people are just, they believe it. The media is selling it. You know, I was looking through something for somebody before about the 60 Minutes episode on untreated, you know, violence or whatever, and Tory and the prisons and all of this crap. That 60 Minutes special happened on not too long ago. And, you know, so I finally found it, and I'm playing, you know, the video of it. And before the video will play, there has to be a commercial. And so the commercial is for Viagra. And so, you know...
Yeah.
Viagra is sponsoring the push toward institutionalizing all people who are psychiatrically labeled, and at the root of many of the issues for some people is sexuality, and yet, like, this pill is okay and that pill isn't. And, you know, the idea that they're covering covering the funding for this episode with, because it's I'm pretty sure Viagra's Lily, right?
Yeah, I think.
And so
I don't want to
jump on that and say that, but I'm pretty sure it is. And
you know,
go ahead.
I want to talk about how our movement uses this word recovery. And it uses it a little different than the folks in the drug and alcohol world use the word recovery. But what I mean by recovery is that, if you lost your keys and then all of a sudden you found them again, you could say that you recovered them. So I started thinking about what is it that I lost? And then what is it that I subsequently recovered? Well, I realized when I went to the psychiatric system and asked them to help me, I gave them all my power. So that was my first loss. The next thing I lost was I expected that because they were the expert, that if I didn't get better, it couldn't be their fault. It must be something I'm not doing right or I'm doing wrong. And so if I don't get better, I must need to journal more, or I need to see the therapist more often, or I need group therapy, or I need to take more psychiatric drugs or different psychiatric drugs, or I need to do this or that. And it all came down to me because I couldn't blame them. They were the expert. They had the answers. And if I'm not getting it, it couldn't be their fault. It must be me. And so the more I blamed myself, the deeper I fell into this whole self-blaming thing, and the more I lost myself, my self-confidence, my self-esteem, my self-worth, until I looked like so many of the mental patients I see these days, walking along, head down, stoop-shouldered, shuffling from place to place and measuring time, from cigarette to cigarette, from big gulp to big gulp. And I was one of those people until I realized this is what I've lost was me. And I set out to recover me. And I got to tell you, I was timid and I was scared. The first time I stood up to and questioned and challenged the authority of the doctor scared the hell out of me because I thought, oh, my God, maybe they won't have anything to do with me. Maybe I will lose their expertness in my life, and maybe I won't get better if I don't have their expertness in my life. But the first time I questioned and challenged, and I started to recover a little bit of me, and then I questioned and challenged again, and I recovered more of me and my self-confidence, my self-worth, my self-esteem, until I recovered myself, and I became, the person I am now. It's not like recovery takes forever. I got me back, and I don't belong to the system anymore. But it's really tells us what we are going to need to do to help people overcome that brainwashing. It's a scary, scary kind of thing.
It really is. And who they define you to be. And so, you said this expert, this expert status that this doctor has and challenging the authority. And so because people just really do. I mean, in part, the quote-unquote doctor is trained to treat the people as objects, and not as people that they're working something that needs to be worked on and fixed. And then the people are trained to trust the doctors. Right.
Yeah, and what that leads to is I became my primary role in life became mental patient. I have many roles in my life. I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm a friend, I'm a student, I'm a teacher, I'm a worker. I got lots of roles in my life. I'm really happy and proud to be grandpa. But at that time, my primary role in life was mental patient. And the real tragedy and sadness of that is that if I had an appointment with my therapist and my wife or kids needed something, you know which one I chose? I chose to see that therapist because it was that important to me to fix me and do what they said, and they were that important in my life. And that's what we've got to help people do, is to recover their self and not let them, you know, be held. And people don't even realize how they may be held captive by the system. They've lost their identity as a worker, as a student, as a friend, as all kinds of things. And that's how we can deprogram and help rescue people from that brainwashing, is to help them restore that sense of self. And we'd really be doing society and our communities a great favor if we do that.
I agree with you completely. And I think, you know, there's another caller who comes in a lot named Maria, and she often talks about how while people are in there, they also need to know that they have rights. So that despite the whole fact that psychiatry is a fraud and you know, while we're all doing this and they're stealing ourselves from us and taking away people's, you know, just brainwashing people, and then there's in this cult, that there's still rights that people possess inside of this whole fraud that people need to be informed about, and that we need to also, at the same time, trying to break the brainwashing of also trying to educate people that they have rights and that they have value and that they should be able to use their rights. And speaking up to the doctor or being able to determine what doctor you have, for example, like those kinds of things, when you're in a position of less than, when you're in the active, like, quote-unquote, mental patient role, become really hard to do. And on some levels, it's because, I like that you said before, the Stockholm Syndrome, because people become, they really do take the side of their captor and see them as people who are trying to help them and good people. And I don't know how to break that on a large scale, but it's nuanced in the trainings and in the textbooks that psychologists, you know, psychology students and stuff have to read through and all. It is so intentional of the way that the indoctrination happens.
We have to confront people with facts too. They say we have rights, but we don't really. They say, you know, when you're in there, you have the right to be in there on a voluntary basis, which means you have the right to sign out and leave and all that, until you actually are locked in there behind the locked door and then try and leave. And they say, oh, no, you're not allowed to leave. Let me check with the doctor. And all of a sudden they've got an involuntary hold order on you, and you're in there involuntary, which means you weren't really voluntary in the first place, as long as that other is hanging over your head. But they like to create that illusion that you're somehow going along with it. That's part of what scares me about the Murphy legislation, is, you know, it's one thing to be locked up and you know, they lock up your body, but it's quite another to where they put your mind in a chemical straitjacket by forcing you to take medicine. And I know when I was on the inside, I hated it so much that I learned to cheek my meds and wouldn't take them. The Murphy bill wants to have people actually swallow the pills in their own home,
right,
voluntarily, just because some judge has banged the gavel and says, you need to do that. And it's like, excuse me? They want our voluntary compliance in our own demise, in our own,
right,
you know, they want us to voluntarily go along with swallowing these pills. And, you know, and it's like, I'm sorry, that's part of what makes it so scary to me, is they want this illusion of, oh, well, but you did it voluntary, you know. And it's
right,
like,
and we're just
so
assisting,
as long,
you know,
as you swallow the pill and, you know, that leads to your own death. You know, the fact that we're dying 25 years younger than the general population. If you voluntarily swallow the pill, well, then I guess, you know, psychiatry and the rest can't be held responsible.
Right. And, you know, and then there are places like somebody called in, I think it was from Wyoming, that they have medication monitors that show up at your house and watch you. So you have to be at your house every day at the time that you're supposed to take your drug because there's a monitor who shows up to make sure that you've taken it.
You know, the first mental health court in the country was in Broward County, Florida. And it was Judge Ginger Lerner Wren. Now, I'm not saying it's great because I really don't believe in the courts and things like that, but part of what made that particular situation work was the judge held the system accountable. It was really committing the system to the person, not committing the person to the system. So Judge Wren would have somebody in her court, and she would say, what is it that you need to stay out of my court and live you know your full and productive life? And then she'd turn to the system and say, what are you going to do to meet the needs of this person? And she committed the resources of the system, and the system would say, oh, but we don't have housing available. And she'd say, that's not my problem. That's what this person needs. You figure out how to get it.
Right.
And
but
so
that, you know,
housing
that's,
and jobs
that's
are meaningful.
That's the horror of all of these involuntary outpatient commitment laws, and particularly the Kendra's Law in New York State. Andrew Goldstein, who tragically and heinously pushed Kendra Webdale to her death in front of a train, that all of this involuntary outpatient commitment law was, because they had almost wiped it out with the Bellevue Project. It had almost been taken off the table because it was shown not to work and all this other stuff. And then they have this big, horrible thing that happens that the media and the government run in collusion with in order to, you know, push forward the involuntary outpatient commitment programming. And Andrew Goldstein would not qualify for Kendra's Law. In no way, if the involuntary outpatient commitment law existed when prior to Andrew Goldstein killing Kendra Webdale, Andrew Goldstein would not have qualified. He tried dozens, literally, I think it was like 32 times that he was rejected by psychiatric services in New York State, where he was asking for help and he kept on being told no. And so the criteria that somebody is refusing services would prevent him from qualifying for the involuntary outpatient commitment law. So the idea of holding the people who are supposed to be in delivering these services and the service delivery system accountable, where's the accountability? Instead, not only do they not take accountability for the fact that they refused this man assistance, that probably wouldn't have helped anyway. I mean, I have no great faith that psychiatry would have, you know, if he was getting psychiatric involvement, that he would have, that would have stopped this. But now they've gone and turned it so that anybody who's refusing services is now culpable to this or having to be subjected to this law. And it really is such a civil and human rights violation. And the black robe effect that, you know, people keep talking about the power that the judge has, that just by saying this, that now all of a sudden somebody must comply with it and that they use that. But one of the other things that people have been talking about is the lack of an actual fair trial if somebody does wind up getting pulled in on one of these court-ordered kinds of things. That all decisions are made, you know, prior to, backroom decisions between the judge and the counsel. And even if people have expert witnesses to testify for them, that the decision's been made beforehand. And so how do you get out of it? You know,
The media really, and even the politicians, really buy into these stories by family members who say, oh, God, if only, you know, we had used force, then this tragedy wouldn't have happened. And I say, oh, really? Maybe if we had used peer support, the tragedy wouldn't have happened. You know, by using the same, you know, but they want to believe that their fiction, their what-if game, is somehow more legitimate than my own. And
right.
And that's really, you know, kind of funky anyway, you know, that somehow theirs is more legitimate than mine, and it's all just made-up fiction. The other thing is, you know, I used to be a patients' rights advocate in California. And it was And it was at the time when they passed, they started having Reese hearings where we would talk about the capacity or the competence to accept or refuse medications. And it was a separate hearing from civil commitment. And, if, you know, assuming somebody is civilly committed and in the hospital, the psychiatrist would want them to take the medications. And if the person refused, then the psychiatrist would call for this other level of hearing. And I represented people in these hearings, and the bizarre thing was, as soon as we would, quote, win the hearing, you know, that it would be found that the person would not have to be forcibly medicated, that they did have the competence or capacity to refuse, the psychiatrist would wring his hands and say, oh, well, I'm just going to discharge him then because the medication's that I can't treat him. And I used to get so frustrated because it was like, you know, for all of their years of education and training and going to college and medical school and everything else, it really struck me as a sad indictment of the entire profession for them to say that the only tool that psychiatry has in its toolbox is a prescription pad. That's really a very sad indictment of the entire profession.
Oh, come on, Pat. They also have restraints and seclusions and keys and electroshock devices, and they don't only have prescription pads.
Yeah, but if they can't drug them, they would just as soon turn them loose.
It really
that's
is horrible. It's a scam. It's a total scam. And I think, you know, the idea that, you know, the media and the politicians work in conjunction with the state, and they're all, you know, putting forward this thing, and that there's trillions of dollars that are being spent on this, and billions of taxpayer dollars annually that are being invested into this state-sponsored torture, and that we need to keep speaking out about it.
Lauren, I need to say something else controversial. I know, so unlike me, but I want to say that E. Fuller Torrey, the psychiatrist who is behind most of this movement of force,
his license
kept his
should
own
be stripped.
Sister locked away for her entire adult life. And so this is a move on the part of family members. And just like I can look at Fuller Torrey and see what's wrong with that family, I can look at a lot of the members of NAMI, and then I can look at their person who receives services, and I can tell where the problem lies. And I think, now, talk about controversial, I dare them to take me on this, because I've long been an enemy of NAMI. I dare them to stand up to me and deny that a lot of the people who abused their children found solace and comfort and a way to hide behind NAMI and escape the blame for the abuse that they perpetuated on their family members. I'm sorry, I look at too damn many, and then I look at Mommy and Daddy, and I can tell who screwed up in that family, and yet they want to lay the blame. And you know, that may be controversial, but I'm sorry, that's where I come from, is
no,
I think that they are safe haven for a lot of abusers, and that's why they want to keep control of their adult children, is so to keep them from speaking out and recovering and being able to indict them for the abuse that they endured as children.
I think that, you know, there are many people who unfortunately turn to NAMI specifically and organizations like it because it's what's there and that they don't know and they don't know any better. But I'll tell you, when you're in a place of where your mantra is the family is never to be blamed, and we know that 96% of people who are in state-operated facilities have childhood histories of physical or sexual abuse. We got a real problem here, you know. Like, and you know, I think that, you know, what you're saying about this safe haven is definitely interesting, and I don't know from one way or the other, but I think that certainly if a parent isn't taking some level of responsibility for where it is that their kid is at, as a kid, and then as an adult tries to control them in the ways that these people do, while acting as a front for pharmaceutical industries, you know, the way NAMI, and I'll probably, you know, go ahead, like I say, sue me, what are you going to do, take my bills? you know what I mean? Please. The way they are defrauding the public, and in conjunction with the Treatment Advocacy Center, I saw a video of Tori talking about his sister and his family. It's like a minute-long video. It's a Treatment Advocacy Center video where he is discounting that, you know, his parents were told, because it was a, you know, they were using Freudian theory, that there was something, you know, in the family that was upsetting his sister, and, you know, discounting that and saying that we know this is a biological brain disease. There is no evidence of that, that they are defrauding the public in order to get power, authority, and donations. And I think that as a as nonprofit entities, that they should be shut down. I think that Tory's license should be stripped from him for the lies that he is putting out about the evidence of, and the way that they support this, and then the way Murphy and all these people just act as little microphones for them and just sing their song.
Right. Where, well, you know, it's up on my webpage. Look up Pat Risser if you want to find my webpage. It's easy.
Oh, I would ask you if you, yeah, because somebody is already, I was going to ask you right before it ended, but I didn't want to interrupt the conversation, but somebody's already texted asking, who is this guy talking, and how do I get in touch with him? So if you would,
yeah,
if you would again, Pat, tell
it's
people who you are. It's
www.patrisser.com, real easy. But there's a place. Pat Risser, RISSER.com.
Great.
And a few years ago, Fuller Tory was in the audience at a conference, and there were some leaders of our movement speaking, and Tory said that at that time, at that conference in California, he sat there and he listened to these leaders of our movement, and he calculated in his head the number of people that he estimates have become homeless and died as a result of this movement of ours. And he wrote that in an editorial in like a psychiatric journal a couple of months later. And basically he admitted, he says, I sat there and calculated in my head the number of people, and that's him basically admitting that he sits there and makes these numbers up in his head. And what I find astonishing is that now years later, it's appeared not only in that journal, in his editorial where he admitted it, but people have taken that number and quoted it in journal after journal, in article after article, until even Fuller Tory probably believes it's factual. But that's how the fictions around psychiatry become created. And this guy has been a spin doctor trying to sell his books for decades. And he just makes stuff up. But, you know, there was an old saying about, you know, tell a lie often enough and people start believing it. And that's what happens, is they just make this stuff up without any factual basis. So I encourage people to try and, you know, when you want to confront Murphy and these folks, to really dig and get the facts. And you know, that's the only way I know how to fight this.
Right. And yeah, I mean, I think what the story you just told about Tory and this calculating in his head the amount of people that have died from this, from people talking about questions of from a movement perspective, is that somewhere on your website? Because I'm on your website right now, patrisser.com, if anybody's just trying to find it still. Is that...
Yes. Okay.
Which link would it be?
Page, Okay, on the main page, let's see. There are a number of things. Well, there's a number of interesting things on my website. There's one place where it talks about, you know, physical things that can go wrong with the human body that can cause, you know, a psychiatric diagnosis. So if you've got a thyroid out of whack and you're either too high energy or too low energy, you go see a regular doctor. They do a thyroid test, figure it out, and give you a few pills and send you on your way. You go see psychiatry and they say you're either manic or depressed and you've got a mental illness that you're going to have for life. So look at that, medical problems that cause psychiatric behaviors. That's very heavily researched and great information. If you go down almost to the bottom of the page, you'll see something that says NAMI, Family Style Oppression and Misinformation.
Yeah.
And that's the link. And when you click on that, I think it's the very first one on that page, Lies by Tack, Evil or Tory, DJ Jaffe, and Other NAMI Fanatics.
Fabulous.
And that link will tell that whole story about Fuller Tory. That link, by the way, also tells the story of how DJ Jaffe, when he was with New York City NAMI, how he was had it up on the webpage, telling families to turn over the furniture to basically lie to the police.
Is the link to that article there? Because people always ask me where the link to that article is.
Yes,
so that's
it is.
Turn over the furniture article.
What happened was that article was controversial, so they ended up taking it down after a few years. This wonderful thing on the internet now called the Wayback Machine, where you can go and find stuff that's been archived in the past. And so I think the link that I have there is a copy of the article, but there's also a web archive version of that article. Yeah.
Great.
And I've got, when you click on that link in that article right there on that page, it takes you to the web archive version of it, and it's got the full article there.
Fabulous. Because that's something that people have wound up saying, oh, that's not true. And it's like, no, it was true. I just don't know where it is or how to find it. And you've got it. On your website, you actually have so much. And I think that maybe one night you would come on and talk about just your website and all the different information that you've got on there and break it down for people. But for anybody who wants to just look around it, patrizzer.com. This is also where the history of the survivor movement is. And would you just...
200 pages now.
It's amazing. Would you just talk a little bit about that? And
thanks to you, Lauren, and some other folks, I got really interested in the history of our movement. And I found that you know, I personally feel like we're kind of losing some of our history that you know, I've been around long enough that I got to know some of the people who were there in the beginnings of our modern movement. I knew Judy Chamberlain and Ray Unsicker and Howie Harp, and I know most of the leaders who've been around for a long time. And so I wanted to preserve that history because I feel like, you know, new people coming up may not, you know, they may have heard the name Howie Harp, but they may not know who he was and what he did and how he helped to grow this
whole
movement.
In New York, you would think he supported you being on a crisis mobile team or an ACT team.
Right.
but
I want people to also understand that our movement is a movement for human rights. It's not against anything. Our movement is for... We want equal human rights with everybody else. I feel like, you know, we need to have the same rights as people in wheelchairs, people, you know, with Down syndrome, and we actually have less rights than a lot of other people with disabilities. But it also ties in then with the Black Civil Rights Movement, with the Women's Rights Movement. You know, you find things like in our Psychiatric Rights Movement, where people used to be assigned, if you were a doctor or a psychologist at a state hospital, you were assigned patient staff, just like you might have staff if you were a white plantation owner in the early 1800s in the Deep South. We were basically slave labor in state hospitals. And so you can't separate those things out. So you had to look at, I looked at things like the labor movement, and I found that women actually, you know, got most of the rights that children have and things like our eight-hour workday. And so I built on the basic timeline that you had created, and I started investigating, you know, a variety of other timelines to put together something that's bigger and more inclusive of just plain human rights in general. And it all ties in, I believe, together, because we're all human beings, we're all in it together. And, you know, my timeline actually starts, interestingly, about 40,000 B.C. They found some primitive, like 9 different diggings in archaeology have found that there were people who were obviously disabled in some physical ways, and yet they had to have been supported and cared for by the community in order to have lived. And I found it fascinatingly interesting that peer support on that level predated all of medicine by something like 40,000 years.
Wow. That's amazing. And so people can find that and download it. It's actually a separate document, right? People can download it as a...
Yes.
Yeah, as a whole document.
But, you know, it's got books, writings. I've got the Geneva Convention, you know, parts of it are up there. I've got, you know, some of the founding documents of our movement, you know, and you know, some interesting, you know, I just put some whole chunks of things and some pictures up there to help make it more interesting and real for people. So when our modern movement was founded in 1970 in Portland, Oregon, by Tom Wittick, Dorothy Weiner, and Howie Harp, they ended up writing a manifesto, and I tracked down and got a copy of that, and I actually put the entire manifesto from the birth of our movement up there on that webpage.
Fabulous. And again, I really mean it, that I hope that you'll come on and spend a lot of time one night talking specifically about all of this, because I think that I know people call in and give me information that how much they love hearing about the history of the movement and learning all of this information. So patrizzer.com is another great resource. I want to, again, remind everybody that and send solidarity to Toronto folks on July 12th, who will be having their Mad Pride Day and speaking out against psychiatric oppression. And the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day vigil will begin on Sunday, July 13th at 6 p.m. on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health. And it will be held for 72 hours, because 72 hours is how long anyone can be detained, assessed, and treated in determination for whether or not we can be kept longer. And that will be, you know, in front of the OMH in Albany, New York. And you can call the Alliance at 800-654-7227. I will be in Utica tomorrow night preparing for that and organizing. And then at the Bastille Days, July 13th through the 16th, so we will be, again, broadcasting from the road. I do hope that it will work. Pat, I want to thank you for calling in tonight and spending so much time with me. I think that we need to keep on reminding people that assisted outpatient treatment is a legal agreement, that this is about a legal issue, that this is not treatment, that the psychiatry can be a cult, and that this is about social control. And that there are places that are calling attention to child abuse and ending abuse in its tracks, and promoting trauma-informed kind of work, and that we need to keep on reaching out to people about how these things are poison and they are killing us, and speaking out against psychiatry. And I want to thank you all for listening, and I'm going to ask you to keep on speaking out until I talk to you next time. Talk to you soon. Good night, everyone. Thank you.